Welcome to Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. On today's show, we do our regular Talk to the Family Doctor program. We do these shows to give you a place to start and to add to your base of knowledge about health. Our guest today is Dr. Jeff Swearingen, family practice physician from Carl in Urbana. Dr. Swearingen works with people of all ages in his practice, children and grown-ups. So if you have a question for yourself or someone in your family, your call will be welcome this morning. Dr. Swearingen, welcome back to Focus.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be back.
Glad to have you with us. And again, we welcome you to the conversation this morning. You can call with your questions for Dr. Swearingen. The numbers are 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL or 800-222-WILL. You can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. And we also welcome your questions on WILL's Facebook page, or you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is Will Public Media. Well, I thought maybe we could start off by talking a little bit about the impending flu season. I guess technically flu season begins now, but doesn't really hit its peak till a few months from now, right?
That is correct. It starts to circulate anytime in the fall, usually reaches its peak in early winter, but can tail on until spring. So we do encourage people to get their flu shots about now. And certainly, if people forget, it's really sort of never too late to get your flu shot, as long as you haven't had the flu yet. But there will be a number of private offices, medical groups offering flu vaccinations. There are flu clinics through the public health department, and a number of pharmacies these days are offering flu shots as well. So we are encouraging people to basically get it. We don't care where or when. Just try and remember to put that on your schedule and get it done. The issue with flu is sometimes overlooked because most people suffer through it and don't succumb. What they don't realize is that it actually is a fairly high cause of mortality. There are probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 30 to 35,000 deaths per year due to influenza. And those can be significantly reduced if everybody will get their flu shot.
Anything happening this year, you know, in years past, we had worries about the H1N1 virus, swine flu outbreak, that sort of thing. What are we looking at this year in terms of concerns about various strains of influenza?
Well, the H1N1 strain will still be included in this year's vaccine. It's slightly different than the previous ones. The World Health Organizations basically look at what is circulating in the world. They will basically take samples of people with influenza, find out which particular viruses are most active. And the vaccination itself usually contains three components, and it's basically the health organization's sort of best educated guess as to what's most likely to be circulating in the community. So they really have a very good track record of guessing pretty well, but it's not perfect. But there's probably still some overlap in the sense that if you boost your immunity to the three viruses that are in the vaccine, you're probably helping your immunity against others as well.
What else besides the flu vaccine impacts your body's ability to, if not be immune to a particular strain of flu bug, but how do you? What are some other things you should really think about, just in terms of keeping yourself as healthy as possible day to day?
Day to day? All the things Mom used to tell you. Eat your vegetables.
Okay. She did say that, yeah.
Get outside. Get off the couch. Stop watching TV.
Yeah, I remember something like that.
Right. Plenty of sleep.
Yeah.
You know, some of it's really not rocket science, and some of it sometimes is. Many chronic medical conditions, unfortunately in the United States, things like diabetes, or if you have a condition where it's being treated with certain types of medications, your immunity may in fact be less. And we know that immunity gradually declines with age anyway. And that's why the over 65 group because of their age and the fact that they're more likely to have chronic medical problems, are one of the prime targets to make sure that they do get flu shots.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and today is our regular Talk to the Family Doctor program with Dr. Jeff Swearingen, family practice physician from Carl Physicians Group in Urbana. We do these shows from time to time to give you a place to start, to add to your base of knowledge about health. Dr. Swearingen works with people of all ages in his practice. He works with children, works with grown-ups. So if you have a question for yourself or someone in your family, your call is welcome at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL, or you can email your question to will-talk@illinois.edu. And we'll start this morning with Susan in Urbana. Good morning, Susan.
Good morning. I'm calling to inquire about the research side of the vaccinations that are so widely available now. Walgreens, everywhere you can get your vaccination. And of the 35,000 deaths that you mentioned earlier, is there any information about how many of those people have had the vaccination?
I'm not sure that I have any specific numbers regarding whether those deaths are occurring in vaccinated or unvaccinated individuals. They're much more likely to occur in the higher risk groups, the extremes of the age groups, and individuals who have also underlying medical conditions that make them sort of more prone. The idea behind vaccination is, even if they weren't vaccinated themselves, if they are in fact surrounded by individuals who are vaccinated, then they're not going to get the disease because there's nobody to give it to them. And that's probably one of the major benefits of encouraging everybody to get vaccinated, is that you can develop what in veterinary circles are referred to as herd immunity, where if a large enough group of subjects are immunized, the unimmunized ones are generally somewhat protected because they're surrounded by other organisms that can't give it to them because they're vaccinated.
Well, I'm just curious because it's been so widely unquestioned. I mean, everyone, all the information out there is get it. And I guess it's based on the herd theory, but I just do question whether those who are vaccinated also, and particularly in the vulnerable group, you can't tell so well whether it's the vaccine, whether it's the flu or something else that causes the death.
A couple of points here, in the sense that the inactivated flu virus vaccine, and that's the majority of the vaccinations that are given, you can't get the flu from the vaccination. Now, you can have, quote, a bad reaction to it. Your body may say, geez, I didn't like that, but you're not going to get the flu. And in some instances, what people experience is in fact their immune system being activated. They develop fever, they get achy, they feel sort of, you know, out of it for a day or so. And they think, oh, gee, I got the flu from the flu shot. Well, the flu virus itself is dead, with one exception. There is a live attenuated vaccination that can be given, and that's the nasal spray for people who really don't like shots.
Yeah.
But and for the at-risk groups, we don't recommend that they get the live attenuated virus, that they basically get the killed virus.
Yeah.
So and then the other issue in terms of transmission, there have been some studies that basically show in healthcare institutions that maybe up to 20-25% of the staff are capable of carrying the flu virus, even if they don't get sick. And they serve basically as a reservoir for then infecting other individuals. And consequently, in our organization, everybody's supposed to get a flu shot, unless they have, you know, some medical reason not to. And it's primarily to decrease the transmission. So I don't think there are really any concerns about anybody getting vaccinated, with, you know, a few sort of rare exceptions. The biggest problem is that not enough people have been vaccinated.
Yeah. Well, I thank you for your comments. I still have some reservations, but that's the personal thing.
All right. Yeah. Thanks for the call, Susan. And actually, just to follow up on Susan's point, there's also a question of timing here. When people report getting the flu after they got the flu shot, sometimes maybe they actually do have the flu, but it wasn't because of the flu shot. They happened to maybe be closing in on they were going to get the flu that night.
Right.
No matter what they had done.
And unless you had done some formal testing of them in the couple of days before they got their vaccination, there isn't any way to prove that.
Why does essentially injecting a small dose of a virus, alive or dead, work to help our bodies stave off that very same virus in a larger, more dangerous form?
Our body's immune system is geared to essentially recognize things that are foreign to it. And if you overwhelm your immune system by coming in contact with large quantities of any type of infectious agent, you run the risk of coming down with the disease itself. But going back to Jenner's experiments with cowpox in the previous centuries, he basically found that if he took a little bit of cowpox, which was a relatively minor disease but related to smallpox, and if he inoculated people with it, they developed enough of an immune response that when then subsequently exposed to smallpox, very few of them came down with the actual illness. And this was sort of the beginning of the idea behind vaccinating and trying to prevent diseases as opposed to having to treat them after somebody got sick.
You're listening to Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and my guest is Dr. Jeffrey Swearingen, a family practice physician from Carl Physicians Group in Urbana. He joins us from time to time for these Talk to the Family Doctor programs. It's an opportunity for you to pose any and all health questions for yourself or someone in your family. Dr. Swearingen works with people of all ages in his practice. To speak with him, call 333-9455 or 800-222-9455 or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We also welcome questions and comments via WILL's Facebook and Twitter pages. Our Twitter handle is Will Public Media. Phone numbers again, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. And we'll go next to Peggy in Urbana. Hi, Peggy.
I have another question about flu shots. I'm just wondering, is it safe and recommended to get your flu shot at one of the large drugstores, or do you have to go to the doctor?
The answer to that question is that it should in fact be quite safe to go to a drugstore and get your flu shot. Craig and I were discussing off the air before the show started some of the problems associated with the basically medications, drugs, things that can be injected into people. And the question really is it safe? And the answer is if it's coming from an FDA-approved manufacturer and all of the appropriate steps have been taken, the answer is it should be quite safe. But the issue that we had talked about were some of these cases of fungal meningitis that have come up due to contaminated steroid injections in individuals who had been given shots for their back pain. So as far as the chain pharmacies, if they're getting their flu vaccine from approved manufacturers and are following the instructions on the administration of it, it should in fact be quite safe.
Setting aside flu vaccine, can we go too far in protecting ourselves from germs, particularly when we're hearing about the spread of a particular virus? Is it a good idea to make sure that we're exposed to some degree to germs so that we can build up an immunity to them?
Interestingly enough, it's been theorized that there's been such a large rise in both allergies and asthma in children because their environment has become too clean. They haven't been exposed to enough things to generate protective immunity, or in fact their immune system has been skewed a little bit to the point where they develop allergic responses. And so in terms of the old days when kids would roll around in the grass and eat dirt, they're not allowed to do that as much anymore. And that's probably not a bad thing. But the idea that if we get exposed to something in small quantities, that we can develop immunity to it is, in fact, quite true. And most kids, if they're, say, in daycare, nursery school, when they go to kindergarten, they're constantly being exposed to other kids who are constantly carrying all sorts of things. And so it's not terribly surprising that kids at that age get lots of common illnesses. And then surprisingly, then the incidence of that decreases as they get older. And so most of the time, as an adult, if you're otherwise healthy, you come down with a cold or a flu maybe once or twice a year, and it's because you've run into something new. You're constantly running into other things that you've probably already been exposed to and have developed immunity to, so you don't get sick.
Let's go next to Richard in Indiana. Good morning, Richard.
Hello. I have diabetes. The question deals with a buddy of mine who also has diabetes, and he just started out with the pills, which I'm still on, and now he's moved to the insulin. And in fact, he called me this morning and said that when he got up this morning from bed, he was up, broke out in a cold sweat, which is usually a sign of low sugar, and he went and got some, chalk and stuff. But the background is this, is that he'll go out and get a huge jelly roll, engulf it, then give him a shot of insulin. And at other times, his eating habits are pretty bad. But he keeps saying, everything's all right when I take my blood sugar. Occasionally it's too low and too high, but most of the time it's okay. I just want to know if that's okay, and if not, I'm going to start pushing him about taking care of himself. He's 63.
Mm-hmm.
And other than that, he's in pretty good health, but he seems to be somewhat cavalier about using his diabetic medicine. And I just wondered if there's any war cries or some kind of argument I can come up with.
Well, you are a very good friend to be concerned about him. So
yeah, I don't want to lose him,
Well, there are two types of blood sugar tests that we commonly look at. The one is where you prick your finger and you put it on the little strip and you test it, and that tells us what your blood sugar is right that moment. Doesn't tell us what it was an hour ago or what it's going to be, 2 hours from now. But the other type of test that his physician is probably periodically checking is called a glycosylated hemoglobin, and this is often referred to as an A1C test.
Yeah.
And this is a blood sugar test that you have to draw out of your arm, not just a finger stick. But it basically tells how well have the sugars been controlled over the last 2 or 3 months. And that's ultimately what we're concerned about, is the long-term control of somebody's blood sugar. So if his A1C is over 7, then his diabetes is really uncontrolled. And the mainstay of treatment for diabetes is diet and exercise. And an adjunct to that is medication. In some instances, people have enough innate insulin production that if you enhance it, its effect, with oral medications, you can achieve good control of their blood sugars. In some instances, people don't have enough insulin production left and that the oral medications aren't effective. And at those particular times, those individuals need supplemental insulin. But is it appropriate to say, okay, well, I'm just going to take a little bit more insulin because I had this big jelly roll? The answer is no.
Yeah. He's never mentioned, I never pushed him on the A1C. I don't know what he's ever had a reading on that. So I'm going to start asking about that.
Okay.
I think I'll start doing that. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Thanks very much for the call. And we welcome your calls this morning for Dr. Jeffrey Swearingen, family practice physician from Carl Physicians Group in Urbana. It's our regular Talk to the Family Doctor program here on Focus. To speak with Dr. Swearingen, call 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. How can you tell when it's the flu and when it's just a cold?
As a general rule, the flu is a little bit more abrupt in onset and a little bit more severe in its presentation. It's not uncommon to have somebody say, I was fine, and then all of a sudden I had shaking chills, fever, and then just felt like I got run over by a truck. And then subsequently the cough starts. People are sometimes use terminology a little differently, and I think in the medical profession we sometimes contribute to that confusion. But influenza is a respiratory illness. Now, many people who say, oh, I had vomiting and diarrhea, I must have had the flu, are typically referring to viral gastroenteritis. And it has frequently in the past been referred to as the intestinal flu. But there are, in fact, two different diseases, and your influenza vaccination will not protect you from gastroenteritis.
Since we're talking about gastroenteritis and digestive issues, one of the things I've always been curious about is why it is some people are just fine with really, really spicy food and some people are not. I'm just curious, what is it that's actually happening as food goes down our gullets? If for some people, down in a pepperoni pizza is no problem, and then for other people, boy, keep them away from curry. You know what I mean?
Yep. Yeah, and I'm not sure I have any great medical explanation other than to say that the world is an interesting place and we're all different. And
fair enough.
Some of us are short and some of us are tall and some of us tolerate that and some of us don't. But quickly in situations like that, we invoke the old famous doctor joke, which goes, "Doctor, it hurts when I do that." The doctor says,
"Well, don't do that."
Don't do that. Yes, exactly. So,
point taken. Let's go next to Susan in Urbana. Hi.
Hi. I subscribe to the Smithsonian Magazine, and they also get an online newsletter. And in the current issue, there's an article about can you give the flu to your dog or cat? And it's of concern not only for the health of the animals. Apparently, there were people who were hospitalized for H1N1, and their cats also showed flu symptoms and died. And that's got the attention of some veterinarians at Oregon. Oregon State and Iowa State University. And they're not only concerned about the animal's health, but they're also concerned that when you have transmission between species that you're more likely to get viral mutations. And most of the time, this article is pointing out that we've been concerned about ones coming from animals to us, which is what the concern was with the virulent swine flu and bird flus.
And also applicable to HIV.
Yes,
which
HIV,
was originally found in animals.
I think syphilis initially may have come from, other kinds of things, because we've been associated closely with domesticated animals.
Right.
But I hadn't heard about this business about animals catching flu and it possibly then mutating and giving back to us something even worse. I thought it was interesting. It's in the Smithsonian.
Well, thank you for sharing.
Thanks for the call. Any other thoughts about that?
No, I'm not really much of an expert on what happens to cats and dogs. You'll have to get a veterinarian to come on and talk to you about that one. But the caller's information is correct that some illnesses have, in fact, originated in animals and been transmitted into the human species, and since we hadn't previously been exposed to it, it can cause some really big problems, HIV being a very good example of once that got gone, there wasn't seemingly any natural immunity to it, so it basically spread pretty darn quickly. But the reverse, I don't see from a biological standpoint why that could not be true, and then within a given species, if the offending either bacteria or virus undergoes some additional change, could it be transmitted back to humans? Yes.
So don't just go around sneezing on your dog all the time.
Well, right. Perhaps, you know, another reason we ought to vaccinate more people to save our pets.
We're taking your questions today for Dr. Jeffrey Swearingen, family practice physician from Carl Physicians Group in Urbana. It's our regular Talk to the Family Doctor program here on Focus. To speak with Dr. Swearingen, call 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL, or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. And we will take more of your calls and emails after a short break. This is Focus.
On Fresh Air, you'll hear revelations from well-known actors, like Zach Galifianakis on the story behind his last name.
It's actually shortened, Terry. My real last name is Galifianakisberg. That's an exclusive for your show.
Fresh Air, bringing you some of the biggest names in American culture and some of the most difficult to pronounce. Join us.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Burlingame Home Inspection and Performance. Burlingame performs property inspections along with energy audits and ratings for Energy Star, tax credits, and efficiency mortgages, all utilizing infrared technology. More information is at cusaveenergy.com or 217-649-1173.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and today is our regular Talk to the Family Doctor program with Dr. Jeff Swearingen, family practice physician from Carl Physicians Group in Urbana. We do these shows to give you a place to start, to add to your base of knowledge about health. Dr. Swearingen works with people of all ages in his practice, children and grown-ups, so if you have a question for yourself or for someone in your family or maybe a friend, your call is welcome this morning at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL, or you can email your question to will-talk@illinois.edu. And we do have an email question for you, Dr. Swearingen, from Subhash asking, does folic acid contribute to the development of colon polyps?
I am not aware of any association between the use of folic acid and colon polyps. So to the best of my knowledge, no.
That's one example, folic acid, of supplements that a lot of people will take for one reason or another. What are circumstances where it's appropriate for someone to take a particular supplement?
In terms of things that are available, if you look at vitamins and minerals, mm-hmm. and various other, quote, natural remedies that are available in the United States, there is sort of an entire alphabet soup from A to Z of things that people sort of can take. And people do take them. The supplement business is a multi-billion dollar industry. And they are essentially allowed to say almost anything to sell their product because they're not FDA regulated. And if you see some of the commercials on TV and you read the very, very fine small print at the bottom, it says this product is not intended to diagnose, treat, or prevent any disease. Yet they just spent the last minute telling you how wonderful it will make you feel.
Well, let me just say as an aside, one of the fun things to do if you happen to have a DVR or something and you can pause
long enough to read that.
Read that fine print on any of these commercials. Very right. Entertaining reads.
Right, right. And so basically all sorts of things are claimed to do, provide all sorts of benefits, but they've never been necessarily subjected to any formal testing. It doesn't have to be FDA approved in order to be able to say it. And so you get a lot of what we call testimonials. You know, somebody says, my Uncle Charlie took this and X went away. Well, great. Okay. Does that mean it'll work for everybody? Well, no.
Well, it also follows these trends. I mean, I remember years ago, it was all about vitamin C. You had to take in X amount of vitamin C and you'll be healthy. You'll avoid colds.
Right.
And then
Linus
over time,
Pauling, who was a Nobel laureate,
yeah.
basically push that. And because he was a Nobel laureate, he got a lot of attention for it. And yes, it got into popular culture, but it's really never been substantiated.
And then you sort of reach a point where you look at the recommended daily allowance of vitamin C and realize that, you know, one cup of orange juice, pretty much you've exceeded it for the day.
Right.
Yeah.
And vitamins come in sort of two categories. There are what we call water-soluble vitamins. When you take them in, your body essentially absorbs what it needs, unless you have some, you know, medical problem that prevents you from absorbing it. And the rest of it simply gets eliminated. They're water-soluble. They end up going out in the urine. The other vitamins, and it's a smaller group, A, D, E, and K, are fat-soluble. And those are actually stored in the body. So it is theoretically possible, and it has occurred, that people have, over time, taken so much that they've actually produced toxic levels in their body. And so the fat-soluble vitamins, you really do have to be kind of careful. With the water-soluble ones, you're just basically watering your lawn with some extra vitamins. And the problem with sort of drawing any conclusions, there are a few times when people have actually documented deficiencies of certain vitamins, and replacing them back into the normal range certainly seems like a reasonable thing. But if it's already normal and you're taking more, what additional benefit do you get? Nobody's actually established that you get any additional benefit. And occasionally there are, in fact, problems associated with it. There was a large study that looked at this fairly recently and basically found more medical problems in people taking more supplements than people who didn't. Again, it's just a large population study, so it's not a cause and effect type thing. But there certainly wasn't any proven benefit to taking something unless you were truly deficient in it.
I want to come back to this and talk about some of the things that people will take, specifically because they believe it'll stave off a cold. But before we go there, let's take another call. We have Mike on the line from Clinton. Mike, good morning.
Yes, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My daughter, who's 20 years old, has suffered with kidney stones to the rate of one or two per year since she was 18. And she was just recently told it's because there's some acid that helps break up those crystals that she has basically none of. And the doctor told her that a possible curative thing would be just to drink two or three beers a week. And stranger things have happened. I just wondered if that was based in any sort of sound fact.
Yes, it is possible. There are people who have what we call metabolic stone disease. They either produce too much of a substance or they fail to get rid of a substance in such a way that it allows it to accumulate. And if it's a substance that is ultimately processed through the kidney, the excess can, in fact, end up forming the inner part of a stone. And depending on what she tested sort of for or deficient in, it is possible that, yes, there are certain times when people are specifically advised to either add or subtract something from their diet to minimize their chances of forming stones.
Okay. All right. So, but you're not aware of any direct correlation between the two, something in beer, you know?
It would depend on what her study showed.
All right.
But yes, it's possible.
All right, thanks for the call. Well, I guess, if there are certain things that beer can do as it works its way through your digestive system, mm-hmm. and it can break down, there's some acidity or something that breaks down those materials, then there's a potential benefit there.
Right.
That should not, however, be an excuse for just anyone to say, oh, okay, well, clearly I need to add more beer to my diet.
Exactly.
All right, so I was talking about as we were discussing, vitamins and minerals that people, you know, ascribe to. Two ideas that people refer to pretty regularly, and you see lots of products associated with this when it comes to attempting to stave off a cold, is zinc and echinacea. What are they, and why is it that there are some folks out there that will, say, oh, I swear by this. If I take in a certain amount of zinc or echinacea, when I feel a cold coming on, it'll stave off the cold.
And there have been some small studies with zinc that suggest that if, in fact, you can get it in soon enough, it might potentially be helpful. And it's thought to be an aid to the immune system. The echinacea has been studied several times, and you can find some that say yes, and you can find some that say no. In most instances, if somebody wants to use something early in the course of their cold and they find it to be helpful, fine. It's pretty much, in both instances here, something that you're only going to take for a few days. Not likely to be harmful unless taken in, again, large quantities over a long period of time.
Well, when you say fine, the impression I get is, and forgive me if I'm wrong here, is that you're basically saying, well, this won't do any harm. I don't personally think it's going to help you at all, but I don't want to offend you.
And that's what I tell folks all the time.
Okay.
Exactly that.
Okay.
To the extent that people's belief in something is strong, there is definite medical benefit to that. Otherwise, placebos wouldn't work. And what we find in placebo studies where people are given an inert substance but told this is going to give them benefit, the positive response rate to that is somewhere in the neighborhood of 30 to 35%. Well, clearly something changed. And there is very definitely the possibility that one's mental attitude changes one's internal chemistry. And so I'm not going to discount that at all.
If you think it'll help, it helps.
It may indeed help. Otherwise, placebos wouldn't work at all.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. There's still some time for your questions for family practice physician Dr. Jeff Swearingen at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455 or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. The phone numbers again, 333-WILL or 800-222-WILL. Well, I'm happy to continue chatting with Dr. Swearingen, and it's a pleasant conversation. Really, this hour is designed for you to call in with your medical questions, and so we do hope that you will call us again. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. One of the stories in the news recently, in recent days, a rare disease called fungal meningitis has popped up. An Indiana health official says that state now has 8 cases of it linked to a tainted back pain medication. 90 cases have been diagnosed nationwide. At least 7 people have died from this disease. And it's linked to a steroid produced by a specialty pharmacy in Massachusetts. That steroid has been recalled. This is obviously a very unusual situation. What steps, if any, can doctors and patients take to ensure that any kind of medication prescribed and used is safe?
This is, in fact, an extremely rare problem in the sense that fungal meningitis itself is very, very unusual, and two, in the sense that what should have been a sterile preparation obviously somewhere along the line was contaminated with fungal organisms. Unfortunately, on the receiving end of a shipment from a licensed manufacturer that supposedly has its facilities being monitored by all the appropriate regulatory agencies, there really isn't any way for a given individual or even the physician to know that a particular batch of medication has been contaminated. And it's only when they start recording multiple cases that are odd and unexpected that they can then go back and find out what did these cases have in common, and that's how they traced it back to the injections. In certain instances, medications are kept in physicians' offices in what are called multi-dose vials. More than one injection can be given, drawn up out of a bottle. There, it's extremely important that the physician or nurse who's giving the injection follow proper sterile technique to ensure that the remaining medication in that vial remains sterile. And there are tried and true methods of using a multi-dose vial bottle to prevent contamination. The one way to avoid that is to use a single dose vial, one per patient, Those are more expensive, but obviously nobody else has used it. So it is one way to assure that it hasn't been contaminated since it arrived in the office. But if it arrived in the office already contaminated from the manufacturer, there really isn't any way for the physician or the patient to know.
But then for things like general medication, you know, over-the-counter drugs, bottles, pills, you want to make sure that, you know, the cap is tamper-proof and has not, in fact, been tampered with. That's
a simple example. That goes back to the big Tylenol poisoning case from a number of...
It was back in the 80s now.
I mean, it's been quite a while now, but that's essentially what led to all those requirements for tamper-proof packaging. And so consequently, yes, if you open up something that you buy in the store and it's obviously been disturbed, I would just take that right back and not use it at all.
And sadly, I miss capsules. I know they changed into those caplets, and they're fine. But what I remember about those is I like the capsules went down more easily, I thought. Anyhow, moving on. Ray is in Effingham. Hi, Ray.
Hi. My brother, years ago... I had weakness on the left side, was limping, and at first he was diagnosed with a stroke. Then other doctors thought he might have MS, and we were told like a spinal tap would give the answer, and he had a spinal tap. And the doctor said, yes, you have MS, but then a couple years later when he went to another doctor, they got the report that said, I suspect he has MS. So does the spinal tap actually verify? Because he doesn't have health insurance, so all these tests, he can't afford to have them done over and over and over. So
there are some specific findings that you can look for in spinal fluid that can help confirm MS, but there isn't necessarily an abnormality in every MS patient's spinal fluid that's always present. So it's not a definitive test, but yes, you can get some information from a spinal tap about MS that would point you in that direction. But there isn't an automatic one specific test that says, yes, you have MS.
Okay, and he has another disease, and I can't pronounce the name. It's pain in the jaw where it's just excruciating pain. The nickname for it, suicide disease, on the internet, but and he's being treated with pain pills for that. Do you know anything about that disease?
I've never heard that particular term before. The most common jaw-related painful condition that we see is TMJ, which is just temporomandibular joint syndrome, which is a little arthritic problem in the jaw where it connects to the skull.
I was just looking this up online as you're talking, and there's something called trigeminal neuralgia, disorder of the trigeminal nerve, the fifth cranial nerve, and I guess it leads to sharp stabbing pain in the cheek, in the lips, and I guess the jaw as well.
And that's a neurological problem, some of which are due to pressure on the nerve. Occasionally surgical procedures to take pressure off the nerve will help. Some are thought to be due to a viral infection that gets into the nerve. Others, we literally don't have any idea why it's behaving like that. Isolated nerve abnormalities can, in fact, be seen with MS, so it could potentially be a manifestation of that.
Does it say about any treatment for that besides pain medication?
Actually, because it's nerve-related pain, very commonly what are referred to as nerve medications, and I don't mean the anxiety nerve kind of medication, but actually medications that fall into the anti-seizure class of medication are commonly used for this. If you... think about seizure disorders, they're a major electrical abnormality in a whole bunch of nerves in your brain. In things like trigeminal neuralgia, you have an isolated nerve that's acting up, but the medications that quiet those nerves in seizure disorders often work in trigeminal neuralgia as well.
Okay. Well, thank you for your information.
All right, thanks very much for the call. We have just a few minutes left, and we welcome your phone call this morning for Dr. Jeff Swearingen at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL or toll-free 800-222-WILL. I was wondering if you had any thoughts about there's a new review published last week in the British Medical Journal, BMJ. It suggests physical activity programs for young people rarely, if ever, increase the overall daily physical activity of these kids. That children studied would exercise during the programs themselves. And there's a wide range. There were some that were kids in preschool, some in high school, all ages. But they'd exercise during the programs themselves, but then not after that. They'd sort of resume whatever sort of sedentary experience they were having over the course of the day. What, if anything, could we take away from a study like that?
That it's probably going to be increasingly more difficult to encourage people to be active, especially given the proclivity of kids these days to entertain themselves with electronic media, whether it's their iPod, iPad, video games, whatever, their activities that aren't particularly physically active. This is thought to be contributing to the increase in obesity in children, the increase in diabetes then as they enter into adulthood, and those all have long-term health implications. So in terms of what you can do about it, sort of enforced activity in the school setting, PE seems to have become somewhat optional these days for many kids, and it's probably still important for them to have regular physical activity as part of their school day. And I think the other part of this is what sort of example is being set at home. If mom and dad aren't very active, there's probably not much incentive for their kids to be active. But, if mom and dad go for a walk after supper and take the kids along, it becomes a habit. It's a routine. Basically, the idea of telling somebody what they ought to be doing doesn't work as well as showing them a good example. Do what I say, not what I do, doesn't usually go over very well with kids. They catch onto that pretty quickly that you don't really mean it.
Another study caught my eye. This goes back a couple of years now. But it suggested that people who sleep less than 7 hours a night are about three times more likely to catch a cold than people who slept 8 hours or more per night.
And there is a correlation between good quality sleep and a better immune system. So there, as we went back to the beginning of the show, mom's advice of eating your vegetables and getting enough sleep are two really, really good pieces of advice that can, in fact, be shown to be true if you formally study it. And that's been known for quite some time that poor quality sleep and inadequate sleep basically lead to increased risk for a number of health conditions.
Finally, today, and this is a question I could probably ask you any time, and I probably will the next time you're here, but if you could, I love asking the magic wand question. If you could wave a magic wand and force all of your patients to do one thing, to change one habit, what would it be?
Stop smoking.
Yeah.
Number one.
I hear that from every doctor. I've asked that question of many doctors through the years, and they all say the same thing. It's always stop smoking.
I think it's probably the leading cause of preventable disease. And stopping that would have a huge, huge benefit. And once everybody stops smoking, I'd tell them to go out and get more physical activity.
Well, and then, of course, the other lesson we can draw from today is it's okay, though, to drink a couple of beers.
There you go.
Yeah. Oh, wait. Now you're hedging your bets.
No, I'm not going to disagree with that long as it's not done all at the same time.
All right. Dr. Jeffrey Swearingen is a family practice physician from Carl Physicians Group in Urbana. Dr. Swearingen, thanks for being with us today.
Greg, thank you very much.
We welcome any additional thoughts you have about today's program on our website, will.illinois.edu/focus. A reminder, you can hear this program twice each weekday, live at 10 a.m. Central Time, then repeated weeknights at 8 on WILL AM 580. If you know someone who might enjoy hearing Focus but can't tune in during the day, let them know about our evening rebroadcast. Also, if you know anyone who might enjoy hearing Focus but lives outside of our listening area, let them know we stream the program live every day at will.illinois.edu, where you can also listen back to past programs. Each day's show is usually up on the web by early afternoon. Focus is also available as a free downloadable podcast. To sign up again, visit the Focus page of our website, will.illinois.edu/focus. On tomorrow's show, it's a natural tendency each presidential election year to compare how the campaign is playing out to what happened during previous elections. How is 2012 like 2008, like 2004? While every election brings its own issues and conditions and the electorate itself changes, there may well be some lessons to be learned from recent history that can tell us why this year's campaign is playing out as it is. We will explore parallels between the 2012 presidential election and elections from the past 50-plus years with Alan Lichtman, professor of history at American University, and John Jackson, visiting professor from the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute at Southern Illinois University. That's on tomorrow's show. Also, this election season, Focus is providing you with the opportunity to speak directly with the candidates in a couple of key races, those running for Illinois' newly redrawn 13th Congressional District and the candidates seeking to represent you in Illinois' 52nd State Senate District. We will continue Wednesday with the Democratic candidate running for Congress in Illinois' 13th District, David Gill. He faces Republican Rodney Davis and Independent John Hartman. All three candidates are vying to replace retiring Congressman Tim Johnson. We spoke with Hartman last month. We'll speak with Rodney Davis next week. Dr. David Gill will be our guest on Wednesday. Today's show is produced by Travis Stanzel, Kyle Mabries, our technical director. He handled your calls. I'm Craig Cohen.